now with over 25 years of experience integrating mental health and spirituality, the author of Reclaiming Authenticity, When Ancestors Weep, and Redeeming the Bereaved. Here is Dr. James Hauck.
Well, hello, everybody. Good afternoon, one and all, wherever you are in the world at this time. Welcome to Reclaiming Authenticity, helping you find your courage to reclaim that which has always been in you. I'm Dr. James Hauck, and if you'd like more information about me or to leave me your comments about today's show, I invite you to visit the website. That address is www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. And these broadcasts are also podcasted, just in case you want to go back and listen again, or you can go back into the archives and listen to previous shows that you might have missed. And I just want to say at the outset that I am just forever grateful and thank you for your support over the past year, and would like to say that you now have an opportunity to continue that support by becoming a monthly subscriber. Now, just to make things clear, a subscription is not required to listen to my talk shows or to download them, but it is greatly appreciated. So again, I invite you to go to the website and click on the link, and you'll find where you can choose any amount that you feel comfortable giving. So, very excited to be with you here today, every Friday at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, noon Pacific Standard Time, and every other time in between. So, each and every week, these broadcasts are dedicated to the integration of spirituality and our mental health. And that has always been the focus of these shows, because one of the things that I have found is that down through history, spirituality and mental health have always been kept at an arm's length from each other. But that is not supposed to be, because I've found, and this is where I've been trained in, to actually integrate the two. As an extension, you know, whenever we better understand ourselves in spiritual terms, the more insight we gain in our mental health and vice versa. So this is one of the reasons why I integrate spirituality and mental health. Now, if you would also like to call in and be part of the show, that number is 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. And I'll be taking your calls after the break. Well, for those of you who are tuning in for the first time, I just wanted to say welcome. I am always grateful for first-time listeners. And just in case you are wondering what Reclaiming Authenticity is all about, it is this: Reclaiming Authenticity focuses on the integration, as I said, of spirituality and our mental health, but it's all within the context of our relationships with ourselves and others and God or the divine. And I would also like to say that I'm a firm believer that all of us come into the world already equipped and graced with everything we need in this life in terms of our giftedness, our skills, our talents, grace, strengths, character traits, so on and so forth. The very, very, very best parts of ourselves, exactly who we are. However, as we go along in life, and perhaps due to some unpleasant experiences, we may feel that we need to hide our giftedness and our skills and our talents, or we push our strengths way down so that others cannot see it. Or even, perhaps, we were told that we would never amount to anything growing up, or whatever other voice we heard telling us that there's nothing special to us. But at any rate, when this occurs, we do not realize our strengths and giftedness, our perseverance and skills and so forth. And we often go through life from that place of being wounded or a place of victimization instead of a place of healing and wholeness. and embracing our uniqueness, or acheyatas. And the reason why I place this integration of spirituality and mental health in relationships is because, think of it this way, we often receive our deepest physical, emotional, psychological, even spiritual wounds in relationships. And yet, we can discover our greatest healing and strength and peace and forgiveness and love through healthier relationships. And it all comes back to relationships. I mean, we do not live on an island, and you know, we are relational beings. And so we have to start there. Just what does it mean to be in relationship with one another? Because these relationships, you know, when we experience these painful events, as well as healing, strength, peace, and forgiveness, just might be within our own families or, say, our colleagues and friends. But, you know, always striving to transform, because when we transform, we also transform others by our presence, our grace, and our understanding. How we carry ourselves, how we talk to one another, and so forth. Even the way in which we smile at one another communicates this transformation. Because first and foremost, this forgiveness and kindness and compassion begins with how we treat ourselves. Because whenever we are compassionate with ourselves, we find that we can be more compassionate with others. And when we are forgiving of ourselves, then we can be more forgiving of others. And when we're able to live in gratitude with ourselves, we then discover how this opens our hearts to see and live in gratitude with others. As I said, transformation, first and foremost, begins with us. Well, how is your heart today? I hope your heart is well. I hope you are well. And I pray that if you are struggling today, that you'll find rest and comfort and the peace that you need. Well, again, thanks for joining me this afternoon. This is a very special focus on, reclaiming authenticity. We're going to take a look at just transforming the dimensional energy of intergenerational trauma. And this is something that's always been near and dear to my heart, and just how trauma not only affects one generation, but also generations as it's being passed down, even to generations who have yet to be born. But it doesn't mean that it always has to be that way. Okay, so let's begin by remembering an ancient African proverb that states that it takes a village to raise a child. Okay, it takes a village to raise a child. And I'm sure all of us have heard this phrase at one time or another. It's very catching. It's very true. You know, in other words, the survival of any people extends beyond the immediate family. So indeed, it does take a village to raise a child. And regardless of nationality and creed and race, we are more connected to one another than what we realize. And yet, just as it takes many people to contribute to the development of, let's say, a generation of children, history has been showing us that it also takes a village, or it took a village, to hide the scandals, the abuses, and the atrocities that have now been coming to light. Because you see, no one person or an entity acts alone. No secret remains hidden, and, you know, truth never stays buried. So, yes, dead men and women and children do tell tales of how they died. And honestly, some died of natural causes. Some died at the hands of others, and some people were not even considered worthy to be buried respectfully. But for all of these atrocities and more, it is time for us to begin telling and retelling the stories of how they lived. It's a time for us to see them for who they are and who they were. That is souls. Souls that live on after their hearts have stopped beating and their brainwaves have ceased. Souls that surround us, even today, like a cloud of witnesses, or the communion of saints, if you want to put it in that way. And our ancestors do speak to us constantly through the blood that runs through our veins. And yet, how do we reconcile these events with what we do today? You know, how do we reconcile the past with the present? Because this is the real effort behind healing intergenerational trauma, because trauma has the potential to disconnect us from who we are as a soul, or shall I say, at least our awareness of who we truly are. And the reason for this is because trauma places what I like to refer to as a distorted template over our perceptions. And very inaccurately, trauma says to us, this is all there is. This is all there is to you. This is as good as it gets, so you might as well get used to it. And yet, all lies and distortions that come from other wounded people who have yet to embrace themselves as soul, these are the statements that come from those who have yet to understand this about themselves. So it's very distorted. Okay? In fact, once we embrace ourselves as soul, we may just be astonished to see the power of our soul to not only transcend trauma, and we can also transform our wounded energy, but we can also empower others to do the same. Because still, as history has taught us and still teaches us, many have feared the resiliency and power of the soul. And therefore, many have tried to silence the soul's cry. Well, through killings and murders and genocide and starvations and forced assimilations and humiliations and degradations, and looking at people as savages or primitive and backward or unworthy, unlovable, and therefore disposable, as those in control see fit. And yet, what's heartbreaking to me is that these atrocities have often been committed in the name of God, by people who should see themselves as a soul. In fact, even when killing is done in the name of advancing the kingdom of God, the only thing that is truly advanced is this distorted view from those who will do anything to hang on to their power. Well, as I said, today's show is going to focus on the historical treatment of people. And in particular, I have chosen to talk about the Native American Indians and the events that related to the Carlisle Indian Boarding Industrial School that's located in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. And if you have never been there, I just encourage you to make the trip. Not too far from the capital city, the capital Harrisburg, not too far from Hershey, Pennsylvania, and so forth. And it is relatively small, but it is powerful nonetheless, especially the cemetery. But if you know anything about the history of the boarding schools throughout America, as well as Canada, then you know just how devastating the history has been for Native American Indians. Because quite often, Native American Indians are forced and were forced to carry their scars on the inside, which are not so easily visible, except for, let's say, the explicit res behaviors of alcoholism or homelessness or drug use, crime, and suicide. I mean, those are the things that often make front page news. But what doesn't make front page news is that if we look closely below the surface of these behaviors, we're going to discover the emotional and spiritual symptoms of boarding school trauma. Trauma such as hopelessness and depression, anxiety, mistrust, nightmares, sadness, hypervigilant, and so on. And ironically, these symptoms are also appearing in our Native American youth, who are perhaps one, two, three, even four generations removed from such boarding school experiences. And this phenomenon, of course, leads us to kind of wrestle with these questions. Like, how is it possible that children grandchildren and great-grandchildren are experiencing the same emotional, psychological, and spiritual symptoms as their ancestors who experienced boarding school-related rape, murder, starvation, molestation, and so forth. And are these children and grandchildren simply over-identifying with the stories communicated by their ancestors? You know, the stories that have been passed down to them. And are traumatic experiences locked somewhere in, shall we say, the DNA of survivors, only to be passed down later? And are traumatic symptoms modeled from one generation to another? Well, let's take a closer look at the Carlisle Indian Boarding Industrial School. And let's delve into not only its history, but also the traumatic effects that, yes, have been handed down intergenerationally. So, the Carlisle Indian Boarding Industrial School, it was first established in the late 1800s, somewhere around 1879, and it is located in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, in the eastern part of the United States, and it was the first of its kind located outside the reservations. And this school was modeled, actually, after the Hampton Institute for African Americans, which educated and trained African Americans to assimilate into society. And under the leadership of Captain Richard Pratt, and backed by the United States government and other religious organizations, the Carlisle School was actually held up as a model for all other schools that sought to assimilate, back then, Native American Indian children into productive Euro-Americans. Now, many people of that time period believed that these boarding schools were also the most effective way to stave off a dying breed, as well as integrate the Native American Indian into a thriving Euro-American culture. And Lakota chiefs, as it was recorded back then, Lakota chiefs such as Blue Horse and American Horse and Red Shirt were among the first Native American Indians to send their children to the Carlisle School. These leaders were convinced that by learning the English language and learning English customs and skills, that this was the only real future their children had in terms of survival. And still, others like Lakota Chief Red Cloud or Chief Spotted Tail mistrusted the white way of educating Native American Indian children. But they were urged by Captain Pratt to comply with this new system. And let me read for you just briefly a letter that Captain Pratt sent to Spotted Tail. He writes, "Spotted Tail, you are a remarkable man. You are such an able man that you are the principal chief of these thousands of your people. But, Spotted Tail, you cannot read or write. You claim that the government has tricked your people and placed the lines of your reservation a long way inside where it was agreed that they should be. You signed that paper knowing only what the interpreter told you. If anything happened when the paper was being made up that changed this order, if you had been educated and could read and write, you could have known about it and refused to put your name on it. Do you intend to let your children remain in the same condition of ignorance in which you have lived, which will compel them always to meet the, say, white man at a great disadvantage through an interpreter, as you have done? As your friend, Spotted Tail, I urge you to send your children with me to this Carlisle school, and I will do everything I can to advance them in intelligence and industry, in order that they may come back and help you." And this was, you can find this letter from Captain Pratt. It's in the book Battlefield and Classroom, Four Decades with the American Indian. Now, what astonishes me about this letter is not the persuasiveness, so-called persuasiveness, of Pratt's words to Spotted Tail, but rather the insulting undertone of his letter implying that, you know, Spotted Tail, if you had only been educated and if you could only read and write, you could have known about what you signed and you would have refused to put your name on it. And furthermore, in his haste to provide the United States with a prototypical school for others to follow suit, you know, Richard Pratt also galvanized this condescending perspective that unfortunately carries on to this day. In other words, his arrogance completely disregarded the whole Native American Indian worldview of his day, and namely to their strong connection to the Creator and all living beings. And it also damaged them to stay connected to the Creator in a relationship that is to connect them to living according to nature's cycles, and to learn from animals how they raise their young and hunting and survival and so forth, and honoring traditions of their ancestors, and how ancestors are always a part of the Native way of life and perspective, and how relationships are based on honor, respect, and love, and how families and ancestors are valued, and how children are considered wonkin. In other words, they're sacred, they're pure, and holy, as well as a continuation of their culture. You see, everything and everyone is woven together in an all-encompassing worldview. You cannot separate one thread from the woven fabric without unraveling the whole blanket. And in his letter, as Captain Pratt suggested, that Spotted Tail learned the white ways so that he would not be taken advantage of, instead of dealing honestly with him in the first place. And let's look at it this way. Why would Spotted Tail or any other Native American Indian need to guard against being lied to unless Pratt and others know how people will deceive the Native American Indian? And that's a good question. And furthermore, it also implies that the burden of survival is placed on Spotted Tail. Instead of Pratt reaching out in humility to understand the Native culture. Now, from today's perspective, not much has changed since 1879 and then some. I mean, just recently, even 4 years ago, just look at the protest against building the Dakota Access Pipeline in 2016. You know, because on, I think it was February of 2017, the Native American Indians and other environmental activists were forcibly removed and or arrested from their protest camps. And nonetheless, there are still people today who they think they know what is best for Native American Indians who do not live on the reservations. And what often makes matters worse is that that same type of people represent Indians in government, but they never stop to listen with humility to the real needs of the people. And today's egocentric approach simply continues to what Pratt and others began. Now, although admission to the Carlisle School was voluntary at first, it became increasingly coercive. I mean, Native American Indian children were often taken away from their families by force, and anything less than a total assimilation of the Native American Indian into the Euro-American culture was not tolerated, as set forth by Captain Pratt. And he also wrote that, you know, his philosophy of kill the Indian in order to save the man further pushed this egocentrism as this worldview echoed throughout other residential schools in United States and Canada. And this is what he actually wrote. This goes back to 1892. And he gave an official report to the 19th Annual Conference of Charities and Correction. And he wrote this. He says, "A great general has said that the only good Indian is a dead Indian," Pratt said. "In a sense, I agree with this sentiment, but only in this, that in all Indians there is a race that should be dead. Kill the Indian in him and save the man." And like I said, this was a letter that he had submitted to the 19th Annual Conference of Charities and Correction in 1892. Now, Native American children were made to endure this forced relocation to the boarding school. And in addition to being cut off from their families thousands of miles away, their Indian names, you know, rich with tribal significance, were changed to Christian names. Their long hair, also a part of tribal significance, was cut short. And all Native American clothing and accessories, such as beads and feathers and moccasins and so forth, were destroyed. The children were then forced to read, write, and speak English. And for those children who attempted to speak their own language or follow their religion, they were punished with mouthfuls of soap. And the living arrangements were also deplorable in that the children were forced into overcrowded rooms, and they had to endure exhausting, lengthy work hours. And physical, sexual, emotional, and spiritual abuses occurred frequently at the hands of the educational and religious staff. Now, because of these harsh conditions with little to no medical care, many children had run away. Other children died from exposure to tuberculosis or smallpox. And some children simply could not survive the pain of separation from their family. You know, their health impaired by the school's strict routine. And another letter, not from Pratt, but another letter was recorded. And I'll just read this to you briefly. It says, "It is hard to imagine dying of homesickness. Yet it was a very serious problem for Indian students. Homesickness, with them, became a disease," wrote an official at the Hampton Institute. "And boys and girls actually suffered in the flesh as well as the spirit. They couldn't eat, they would not sleep, and so prepared the way for serious trouble. Because when people do not take care of their bodies, it becomes easier for them to become sick. The profound sadness caused by homesickness weakened the students and made them susceptible to deadly diseases such as tuberculosis and influenza. And these contagious diseases easily spread because of the unsanitary conditions at the boarding schools. It was not unusual for dozens of students to sleep in one big room lined with rows of beds, or for two children to sleep together in a single bed. And this enabled germs to spread easily from one child to another." Well, I would really love to hear what's on your heart. What's going on in you right now as I talk about this subject? So again, if you'd like to call in, that number is 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. And I'll be taking your calls after the break. Again, you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity, and I'm your host, Dr. James Houck. I'll be back with you in 1 minute.
Thank you.
Okay, welcome back. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Dr. James Houck, and you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. Before I go any further in the show, I just want to say a word about next week's show. Tune in next Friday afternoon, and we will be in the lovely month of August. Yes, the year is just flying by. And whenever we get into August, we are, you know, we're reminded of back to school shopping and everything else. So if you have not started, please get out there and make sure that your child, your teenager, is ready for the next school year. And we'll see how that all turns out with this pandemic and everything. But at any rate, just invite you to tune in next Friday afternoon when I'm going to continue this conversation on transforming dimensional energy of the intergenerational trauma. And we're going to take a look, another close look at the mass graves in Ireland. Okay. And this was a place that I had visited years and years ago. This was something that I just felt led to when I had heard and actually read the reports that over, you know, close to 300 children or say baby remains were found in Tuam, Ireland, and that's in County Galway. And it's just something I was able to walk the land and talk to the people who live around there and some of the stories that they had shared with me about what had happened as well as what's being covered up. So again, invite you to tune in next Friday when we take a look at the mass graves in Ireland and how we can transform this lower dimensional energy of intergenerational trauma, because healing is available to everyone. Excuse me as I clear my throat. Well, as I was talking about earlier in the show, Native American Indian children were made to endure this forced relocation to the Carlisle Indian Boarding Industrial School. And in addition to being cut off from families, you know, thousands of miles away, their Indian names, which were just rich with that tribal significance, were forcibly changed to Christian names. And their hair, their long hair, also a part of their tribal significance, was cut short. And all Native American clothing and accessories, such as beads and feathers and moccasins, were destroyed. And the children were forced to read and write and speak English. And as I said earlier, the children who attempted to speak their own language or even follow their religion, well, they were punished with mouthfuls of soap. And living arrangements were also deplorable in that the children were forced into overcrowded rooms and they had to endure exhausting, lengthy work hours. And the physical, sexual, emotional, and spiritual abuses occurred frequently at the hands of the educational and religious staff. And as I also mentioned, because of these harsh conditions, with little or no medical care, many children ran away. You know, other children died from when they were exposed to tuberculosis or smallpox. And some children simply couldn't survive the pain of separation from their families, that their health was impaired by the school's strict routine. Well, by the 1880s, okay, we were just 15 years or so outside of a civil war here in the United States, there were 60 Indian boarding schools throughout the United States. And by 1900, just 20 years after that, thousands of Native Americans were living at 150 boarding schools around the United States. Now, this is not just a United States problem, because to the north, there were approximately 69 residential schools throughout Canada and 80 residential schools by 1931. Okay, and ironically, the last federally run residential school, the Gordon Indian Residential School in Saskatchewan, closed in 1996. And yes, you heard correctly, 1996. So this just wasn't a problem in the 1800s or the early 1900s. This has been going on, okay? And it continues, all right? Because even though that these residential schools and these boarding schools have been shut down now, they've been closed for some time, you know, just pay attention to the stereotypes that are still out there. And the perspectives and, you know, just how people like Captain Pratt and his prejudices and his you know, the way he just tried to promote his own agenda, how that's also carried on today. And governments and religious orders such as Catholic, Anglican, Methodist, and so on, were often seen as extensions of one another, as more often than not, extreme and cruel measures were taken by these systems to separate Native children from their families and to separate Native American Indians from their soul or their soul awareness. Yet, as we have seen over the past decades, as more and more lawsuits are coming out against the once government/religious established boarding schools and residential schools, adult survivors are exposing the harsh treatment they had received. And through their heartbreak and tears, many have shared how they have often were beaten or whipped or burned or thrown downstairs, how they were molested, exploited, and raped by officials. In fact, the adult survivors of childhood boarding schools also suffered emotional, psychological, and spiritual abuses, as many believed that they had been abandoned by God because God's representatives were the ones hurting them. Okay? Well, I want to share with you a story, an experience that I have. I have several Native American Indian Lakota friends, and made friends with them when I was out in South Dakota visiting, and spent some time with them, and developed that relationship. And they just happened to be out in the Philadelphia area, which I don't live too far from. And, it was on, in November. And we were, they were down for, several or out for several days. And, I met them early and, sitting around having breakfast. I joined them. You know, we were just talking about, okay, what is it that you want to do today? And one of them spoke up and said, "Hey, how far is this Carlisle boarding school from here?" And so from Philadelphia, we were easily able to get there through the turnpike in about an hour and a half, give or take. Okay. So it was on a crisp, sunny November morning that we just kind of loaded everybody up in my car we drove to, from Philadelphia to the former site of the Carlisle Indian Industrial Boarding School. And now, as I said, they were in town, and I think we were doing a fundraiser, and they wanted to see this school since their only knowledge of this place was from stories that they had been told or read. And the Native American Indian boarding schools have always been a sensitive subject with my friends because they recall the horrific stories told to them by their tribal grandmothers and grandfathers when they were younger. And several of these experiences have plagued their ancestors with physical, psychological, and spiritual scars that are a constant reminder of how the United States viewed their so-called savage and uncivilized race. Now, ironically, history's patterns of prejudice, cruelty, and mistreatment is not exclusive to Native American Indians, but it also extends to any gender or race or class or ethnicity or nationality and so on in which a society and its systems, okay, and a society and its systems such as governmental, educational, religious, science, etc., any system any society that categorizes people as unworthy, untouchable, or unlovable. And today, many people still look to place specific blame for such brutality, and yet, who's at fault? Okay, who do you prosecute for such crimes against humanity? Can individuals be singled out? Or does blame belong to communities in general? Because let's go back to that African proverb, you know, that stated it takes a village to raise a child. Well, it also takes a village to perpetuate the physical, emotional, and spiritual atrocities. No one acts alone. Now, surprisingly, let's go back into history, you know, a little bit more. Adolf Hitler, does that name ring a bell? Adolf Hitler acknowledged this kind of phenomenon early in his life. He also read about the so-called successes of the boarding schools and the philosophy behind that. And as we all know from history, he took it one step further. But let's read something that he had written back in his day regarding this. He said, "Even in those days, I saw that there was a twofold method by which alone it would be possible to bring an amelioration of these conditions or a worsening of these conditions. The first method is, first, to create better fundamental conditions of social development by establishing a profound feeling of social responsibilities among the public. And second, to combine this feeling for the social responsibilities with a ruthless determination to prune away all excesses which are incapable of being improved." And we all know that what he meant by this was that he wanted to prune away people who didn't fit this, in his mind, the superior race. And this was something that when it came to the Nuremberg trials after World War II, that, you know, actually the doctors who had come over to the United States to learn about, you know, forced extermination and genocide and other things, you know, forced treatments and all that, that's what they claimed, you know, when they were put on trial. It's like, why are you punishing us? Because United States, you're the ones who trained us. You're the ones that first showed us. So who's really at fault here? You know, we can point out individuals and single people out, but let's really broaden the net, shall we? Let's really, you know, talk about, again, how much of a larger, you know, scale does this extend to? If it takes a village to raise a child, so too does it take a village to perpetuate physical, emotional, and spiritual atrocities. Okay, and yet the flip side is also true. It also takes a village to perpetuate healing, compensation, respect, honor, promote dignity, value, and worth among the generations. Okay, and yet and more of these historical atrocities continue to emerge from those whose cries reach our own souls, villages may want to hide their heads in the sand and pretend that they don't see it, or they don't hear it, or they're not going to speak any evil. However, the time has come that we can no longer pretend that we're not part of larger systems that produce and perpetuate the mistreatment of others. Okay, so when my friends and I got to the Carlisle boarding school, we were standing there in the middle of one of the grave sites. And we were struck by the diversity of the Native American Indian and the children and how they were identified by their white gravestones. And among the children buried there were Cherokee, Lakota, Sioux, Inuit, Apache, Pueblo, Seminole, and many other tribal nations. Now, about a third of the gravestones were marked unknown, which represented unidentified children. And each of us, we bless each grave with a pinch of tobacco and sage offerings, and we honored all who were buried there, not referring to them as children, but instead referring to them as grandmothers and grandfathers, the ancestors. And I stood there with my friends, and I listened to their prayers as they poured out their hearts and their tears. And it hit me. In this one prayer of referring to them as grandmothers and grandfathers, their ancestors, they basically unraveled Captain Pratt's philosophy of killing the Indian to save the man. Pratt's philosophy fueled a nation's behavior of assimilating Indians into European ways by, you know, this forced relocation, stripping them of their names, their clothes and hair and language and religion and other native customs. Okay, and thousands of children were portrayed as having been assimilated into the American culture in the historical picture of them sitting on the grass in front of Pratt's home and headquarters. You can Google this, you know, you can even watch it on YouTube. It's there. It's unforgettable. You know, and there's hundreds of Native American children and their teachers there right in front of Pratt's home, just sitting on the ground. And we walked those lands. And as we stood on the grassy land, my friends were deeply moved as they proudly, and I mean proudly, proclaimed through their tears that Pratt had failed because we Indians are still here. Yeah, truth never stays buried because humanity cannot, has not, and will never, ever be able to annihilate people and who they truly are, eternal souls. And despite its simplicity, it really doesn't take a genius IQ to recognize the opportunity governments and religious orders possess to manipulate the truth in order to exploit a people and push their own agenda. And furthermore, it also stands to reason that governments or religious orders can make education into anything they want to be, you know, by distortions of the truth, or just let's call it flat out brainwashing. Because, you know, for example, if you viewed Native American Indians back then as uncivilized savages, well, then you can, you know, design education to teach them accordingly. You know, if you teach Native American Indians who attended boarding schools that their religion and language, etc., is inferior to other societies, then eventually what will students come to believe? And if they are taught that they are incapable of making logical decisions for themselves, how long does it take to turn a group of people into dependents? Because seriously, how much has changed since then? How many of us in history classes were taught the perspective of Native American Indians other than how colonization benefited from white Anglo-Saxon people? And this kind of coercive education, undergirded by the physical, emotional, sexual, and spiritual abuses, makes for a very powerful means to control the hearts and minds of any generation. Well, generations after generations of the Carlisle, you know, of Native American Indians, you know, and after the Carlisle boarding school closed its doors in 1918, okay, Native Americans are still there, still enduring the memories of endless suffering of their people. Native American Indians are still here. And it was reported that over 10,000 Native American children from 140 tribes attended this Carlisle boarding school. But according to the author Hunt, that's H-U-N-T, he had written a book in 2012, only about 158 students graduated, which then leaves the question, where are the others? mass graves of native and non-native people are being uncovered throughout this world. And generations from other indigenous schools are coming forward with eyewitness stories of abuse and death and that have scarred both memories and bodies. And government and ecclesiastical bodies often scramble to offer apologies and comprise truth and reconciliation commissions to ease their consciousness. However, okay, let's kick this question around. Are apologies enough? I don't think so. Not when corrupt systems and illegal practices and entitlements are still evident today. So how do we heal? How do we heal a people who have been told that they are worthless, no good, cannot, you know, amount to anything in their lives? How do we transform that kind of distorted truth, or as I said earlier, flat out brainwashing? Okay. How do you unravel or how do you heal from generations of being educated that they are inferior? And you know, how do we do this? Well, we start by finding the truth, howbeit ever painful. We start with the truth. And we start with the fact that all of humanity, regardless of race, religion, creed, culture, and so forth, gender, all that, when you get to the very core of the heart of the matter, no pun intended, you find that we are all souls. And all the isms out there, all the external stuff that have created these wars and prejudices and fights and arguments and so forth that still go on today are all based on the externals, which none of us had any say over when we came into this world. And yet, we are gifted in grace with very, very beautiful skills and talents and personalities and so forth that are to be valued. I hear it every now and then, you know, from people just where I live and so forth that, you know, I wish, you know, we could find a generation who can solve some of these problems or waiting for people to step up and do things. And, you know, when will they, you know, find it within themselves to find a cure for whatever this or whatever that. And I just kind of shake my head and go, you know, those gifts are already there. I'm convinced of it, but yet how we treat one another, you know, people have, you know, still yet to find the very best of themselves. You know, I'm convinced, and I share this with my clients all the time. I say, look, I counsel new clients and everybody that, you know, basically that come from two very deep-seated beliefs within myself, so just of how and why I counsel the way that I do. And the first one is that I truly believe that people have the answers within. In other words, you know the kind of life you want to lead. You know what brings you happiness and joy and peace and contentment and so forth, and you know what doesn't. And yet at the same time, the second profound deep-seated belief in myself is that I truly believe that people come into this world with everything that they need, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show. All the gifts and graces and talents and skills and personality and so forth. But yet how many times do we hide that out of fear of being persecuted or out of, you know, we swallow the distorted messages that were told to us that you never amount to anything or you simply don't matter. And if there's one thought I can leave you with today, it's this. Don't you dare let anybody define who you need to be in order to suit them. You find the very best parts of you. You find your soul. You find your happiness. Well, I'm Dr. James Houck, and you have been listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. again, invite you to tune in next Friday, and I will continue this conversation on transforming dimensional energy of intergenerational trauma as we take a look at the mass graves in Ireland. But until then, I ask that you would be safe and healthy. And until we hear each other again or see each other again, may God hold all of us in the palm of God's hand. Take care. Bye-bye.
For an answer, or just to leave 1,000 comments, or prodding to buy a book by Dr. Hauk, it's all there. Just wander on over to ReclaimingAuthenticity.com and click around. And we'll see you next Friday at noon Pacific time on PBS Radio TV.